You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, today I have got such a big treat for you. And I'm going to already say that it's a treat for me. So I hope it's a treat for you, because major, major fangirl moment. I have two of the leading scholars who think about, who write about, and who research various aspects of sex work. I've been reading their work and following their careers, but I've never met them. And so this is just, I'm some over the moon. I have crushes on them both. They are just finding that out for the first time. Let me tell you who these two people are. Okay. A professor in the sociology department at University of Nevada, Barb Brentz has spent more than 25 years studying politics, sex, and gender, and is considered one of the world's leading experts on sexual commerce and Nevada's legal brothels. She's the co-author of Paying for Sex in the Digital Age and The State of Sex, Tourism, Sex, and Sin in the New American Heartland. Her peer-reviewed publications examine the politics of sexuality, the intersections of culture and economics, sexual markets and consumption, and the emotional and bodily labor of selling sex. She has received numerous awards for teaching, research, and public service. Ron Weitzer is professor emeritus at George Washington University and currently a research associate at UC Santa Cruz. He has also been in the game for 25 years, including field research in Europe and Asia. His research examines a variety of aspects, including the geography of legal red light districts in Europe, political struggles over sex work, critiques of abolitionist feminist writings on sex work, and standard pornography lab-based studies. Just sort of casual, you know, standard pornography lab-based studies. The views and desires of sex worker clients and issues of decriminalization and legalization. He's published critiques of a set of popular myths regarding human trafficking and sex trafficking in particular. In 2000, he produced the edited anthology Sex for Sale, compiled a second edition in 2010, and is now working on the third edition. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Barb and Ron. Can I call you Barb and Ron?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. And let me say, before you say anything else, that I had a fan crush on you first. And you are the smartest, most well-known and best ethical porn producer, feminist porn producer. And I've heard you speak, and I'm just like in awe of you. So this is a super treat for me.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Should we just go back and forth and give each other compliments? Do you think that's fun to listen to? I don't know. My listeners, though, can always tell when I'm like super jacked up about a guest. Something about my voice, like people will text me and email me and be like, you really like that person. So, okay. Before we get into everything, I kind of want to review the landscape of sex work, right now. There have been efforts going on forever to decriminalize sex work. I think people still have questions about what it means to decriminalize versus what it means to make legal sex work. So maybe we can start there. And also kind of where are we in the efforts to decriminalize? And either one of you can start.
Well, I'll start off and Ron could fill in because that's been the subject of several things that he's written. The legal layout is basically this, and I'll do the simple version, but the reality is it's much more complex. I mean, we talk about decriminalization, which is the removal of all laws that criminalize the sale or purchase of sex or most things around it that aren't also covered in other criminal laws about business and interaction and violence and that sort of thing. So that's decriminalization. Criminalization is what we have in the U.S. where they can criminalize one or more aspect of sex work, selling sexual services, defined however, buying, purchasing, facilitating or pandering or pimping, those sorts of third-party things. So those kinds of things can be criminalized. And then there's talk about legalization, which is allowing sex work to happen in certain contexts, closely monitored by a legal agency, legal entity of some kind. Now, we've always talked about, those three things as if we have a choice between them. In reality, there's a wide range and mix of these kinds of things, and the devil is in the details in a lot of ways. In New Zealand, which is seen as the most progressive model of decriminalization, even there, brothels are regulated within similar laws as other businesses. So the kind of regulation that happens is not in criminal justice institutions as it is in the U.S., but in more business and commerce law. In criminalization, there's the U.S. that criminalizes all sorts of aspects, and we do so through state and local laws. In the U.K., for example, and maybe Ron can clarify this in Europe too, selling sex itself is not legal, but everything around it, selling sex is legal, but everything around it is not legal. So that makes for, it's a criminalized system, but it makes for a slightly different kind of dynamic where sex workers in the UK can actually organize a little bit better than they can here, because in the US they're outlaws. And in places like Australia, where each state has a different kind of configuration, what matters is who regulates what aspect of it, and whether the intent is to stop it or control it, or whether the intent is to give workers rights. And oftentimes, you know, whoever made those laws have got different ideas about what they want, so it's often a compromise. So it gets really complicated at some levels. But that's the scenario. And Ron can fill in.
And right now, sex workers are pushing for decriminalization.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to clarify that for people. Yes. Of all those different models. Okay, Ron, do you have stuff to add to that?
I would just echo everything that Barb just said and just kind of boil it down. I think decriminalization simply means removing the criminal laws, removing criminal penalties against different types of behavior, whereas legalization involves some kind of regulation. It could be minimal regulation, like an extra sin tax added to sexual transactions or zoning into a particular part of a town. It's a very similar parallel to marijuana legalization. So you remove the criminal penalties, and then the next step would be to impose some kinds of regulations on either the workers, the business owners, if they work for a business, even the customers, zoning into a particular area perhaps. Some places require mandatory health examinations and HIV tests. And so you can look at legalization in terms of a continuum from very limited, minimal types of regulations to extremely extensive, maybe obtrusive types of regulations, such as a licensing fee in Queensland, Australia, that is so high for a brothel owner, they have to be paid at the beginning and then every 2 or 3 years, very exorbitant licensing fees to run a brothel, which forces some of them to operate illegally because they can't make a profit. And so there you've got what you could call oppressive types of regulations that are almost designed to keep the legal industry very confined. And so you've got a range of different types of legalization. When you talk about legal prostitution, again, it can be from very minimal types of controls to very maximal types. But decriminalization in itself just simply removes the criminal penalties.
It's really funny that you brought up marijuana, because I recently attended a hearing in the California State Senate where a bill has been put forward to legalize psychedelic drugs. And there was all this testimony about the uses of psychedelic drugs, and they named them. There were like 8 of them. Among them, like MDMA, ketamine, mushrooms, mescaline. I haven't heard that word since high school. And so they had a lot of testimony about its use in treating PTSD, depression, suicidality. They had lots of veterans come forward and testify about how they've used it, but they've had to like either do it super on the down low or leave the country to get the treatment that they want. So then the committee members sort of came on to ask questions, and the parallel I saw to sex work is that this is ultimately a controversial topic and people have very strong feelings about it. Feelings that are like based on feelings and also some, you know, morality and puritanism. And so no one, and it's also deeply politicized, as I would say, decriminalizing drugs and decriminalizing sex work, deeply politicized. And so the folks who commented and asked questions, no one sort of engaged the science, right? Like there were doctors who specialize in this kind of research and this kind of treatment, and they talked about it. But no one really wanted to have anything to do with that. They really wanted to engage on this level of, oh my God, there's going to be people running the running around in the streets with mushrooms, doing mushrooms and slipping mushrooms to people who don't want to do mushrooms. I mean, there was you know what I mean? Like, so I know you guys are nodding because you know what I mean. There was like some panic talk. And I think that's the most challenging about sex work, right? And that's what is so interesting. You know, I first saw on social media this organization that you guys are part of, Scientists for Sex Worker Rights. And I thought, oh, what a novel idea, science. But people will willfully turn away from science when it comes to this topic.
Well, people are going to continue to do mushrooms, whether they're legal or not. They're going to continue to sell sex, whether it's legal or not, and buy sexual services. So the key question is, do we want to criminalize this behavior or not? And if it's decriminalized, then the next question is, are there certain controls that we want to put on this kind of behavior in terms of age limits, perhaps, or conditions under which the behavior can be conducted versus conditions under which it cannot. So with regard to marijuana, for instance, all of the states that have legalized marijuana prohibit it in public. So that's a regulation. Now, whether that's enforced or not is a question, but that does tend to be enforced more against people in marginalized communities than others. And so there's a racial ethnic disparity often in terms of arrests for public marijuana use today. But the key question is, do we want to criminalize this behavior irrespective of what your moral feelings are about it, whether you can see yourself doing it or not? Is criminalization the answer? And the answer is no. It does not work. It's counterproductive. It marginalizes people. It forces them to work under risky conditions. It increases the stigma attached to sex work. And so there's a whole lot of reasons why decriminalization is a far better alternative than criminalization. And that goes for mushrooms and weed and sex work.
Barb, you were nodding during that.
Well, it just lays out the differences between morality and science, although I could also talk about a lot of the similarities between them. But what science does is provide the kind of big picture and puts different parts in connection with each other and provides overall data. Oh, when you do this, this is what we find has typically happened. When you do this, this is what we find has typically happened. And policymakers, just as journalists do, like stories better than they like to hear boring old facts. And Ron has laid that out so clearly. The science oftentimes is a lot more complex. I mean, if you want to find a study that says absolutely in every case, no matter how you do it, decriminalization is going to be better for everybody, that's just not what it is. And you're not going to find one study that confirms all of that. Science is a cumulative kind of thing, and you're going to find in this context, this happens, and this. The way this study was done, we see this part of it, but we didn't see that part of it. And the way this study was done, we see that part of it and not this part of it. And so it becomes that I could go on and talk like that for 50 minutes, and you'll be fast asleep. And that's what good science deals with, all these kinds of nuances and contexts and situates things and tells, you know, the truth of all of it. And that's hard for a legislator who it's quicker and easier to pull from your personal experience and your moral beliefs and not complicate it with the science. But, you know, it's so much easier to do that with sex and with drugs and all those things that we've been told are bad, that generally we marginalize those people who are other and not like us. And you know, the most vulnerable population suffer as a result of this. We pick and choose what we want to say. Oh, well, the science says this is okay. So there's a politics of respectability in terms of when we pick what science we want to use and what we don't. So that's a long answer to where you started out with. Why didn't they talk about the science in this whole conversation? Because it's just...
Yeah, and I think many legislators are more aware of media reports on sex work, which tend to be either sensationalized or focus on worst cases. They're more informed by media reports than they are by any kind of scientific study. And so distorted media leads to distorted public policies.
I've always argued that the media like never tells you the story about the happy sex worker, right? I mean, if we're talking about balance here, you know, for every 5 stories you do about someone who was traumatized in this industry, you've got to have 5 stories about people who walked into it head on their shoulders, can tell you why they do it, can tell you what keeps them safe and what makes them more vulnerable. But we don't hear those stories. Like, those aren't fun, right? Those aren't headline grabbing. It's not clickbait when someone just says, sex worker has been doing this for 15 years and is content with her job, right?
Well, don't you think things are changing a little bit? I mean, Ron and I have been doing this long enough to where, you know, when we first started, we were among the few folks that were, you know, thinking outside of what you hear. Now, there's so many more scholars doing research in this. It's quite exciting. And watching the media, there's so much different media. I will tell you one thing. When we first started, and maybe Ron can say this, although Ron has been stick to the science all the way through, I was struck by the sex work is bad, although that story, it's deviant, sex workers are deviants. And so I started doing the research and I'm like, wait a minute, that's not true. And I have to say, I fell a little bit into the, look at all the research that shows it's wonderful and it's great. And it's perfect for everybody if we just fix all these other things. So I fell into that, oh, it's all great. Everything that says it's bad is all wrong. I think the beauty of where we've come to now is maybe the media has kind of caught up a little bit to, oh, well, you know, it's not so bad. But the variety of scholarship now that's happening is really diving deep into, here are the ways it's good, here are the ways it's bad. We just got to dispel these sort of stereotypes and see the ways it's like so much other work, and look at the way that work has changed in the 21st century, and sex work has changed as well. And to stick to this, oh, it's terrible, oh, it's good kind of dichotomy just misses all of it. And that's why legislators have so much power and potential to pay attention to the details of what policy should be that will actually, I mean, there are ways to compromise, I hate to say it, that would be actually better for a lot of people, that they could, if they would just listen to the science on this.
And listen to the sex workers, as you've also said a gazillion times, right? Is also, you know, I mean, this happened in California with the issue with condoms and porn, is that all these folks showed up in Sacramento to testify and they were like, we don't have time, we're taking a recess, you know, just all these excuses not to hear from actual people working in porn tell you about their working conditions and tell you about condoms. It was outrageous.
That's an important point. Yeah, that's critical. That it can't be missed. I mean, yes, there's a science that they've ignored, but they've also ignored the sex workers, the people that are actually doing this work, as you say.
So we've blown through our first commercial break. So we're only going to have one commercial break. Okay, listeners. So instead of hearing one commercial, you're going to hear two commercials, but then that's all. So let's do that. And when we come back, more with Barb Brentz and Ron Weitzer. Stay with us. Thank God summer is finally here, but you know, there's still plenty to do indoors. Dipsy is an audio app full of short, sexy stories designed to turn you on. Each Dipsy audio story features characters that feel like real people and immersive scenarios, so you feel like you're right there. Listen to stories about unbridled lust, secret hookups, long-term love, kinky adventures. They've got it all. And they release new content every week, so there's always more to explore, no matter what you're into. And if you need to wind down, Dipsy also has wellness sessions, sensual bedtime stories, and soundscapes to help you relax before you drift off. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial where you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/Tristan. dipsystories.com/Tristan. You've got to listen. Support for Sex Out Loud is provided by Manscaped. Hey, it's Pride season. Are you ready to show off your body loud and proud? Do you want to do it with or without a massive bush? Remember, it's always your choice. Well, if you're looking to make your pubes pride ready, Manscaped is the world leader in below-the-waist grooming. I have a Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0, and I absolutely love it. It's the only thing I use for my grooming, and I've gifted it to a lot of people in my life too. Your beautiful body deserves the best new technology, performance, and craftsmanship. Prep for pride with the brand new Lawnmower 4.0 and the Ultra Smooth Package. And do it with a discount. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code Tristan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free worldwide shipping when you use Tristan at checkout by going to manscaped.com. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your jewels. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with two of the leading scholars who've been doing it for more than two decades, researching, writing, and in some cases teaching about sex work along with the various things adjacent to sex work, Barb Rentz and Ron Weitzer. So speaking of adjacent to sex work, another really confounding piece of the puzzle here is that we've seen a sort of collapse between sex work and sex trafficking. Now, I mean, in terms of anti-porn feminists, I will never, ever forget that I was at a conference at Yale Law School, and Gail Dines said, while she was sitting on a panel with me, that I trafficked in women, which is like, you know, always what you want to hear from another feminist. Really intense. So there's been this sort of collapse between sex trafficking and sex work. And then sex trafficking has gotten all this media attention, a shit ton of funding. You know, celebrities are like jumping on the bandwagon to fight sex trafficking and speak out against sex trafficking. And I feel like that's overshadowed all the good work that's being done on sex work. So how do we like disentangle some of these issues? Because I also feel like some of the bad legislation purports to protect people against, protect people from sex trafficking, but in fact it harms consensual adult sex workers.
Well, one way to answer that question is to look at the law. And so the Federal Trafficking Protection Act passed in 2000, and each state has its own trafficking law, defines trafficking as the use of force, fraud, or deception to recruit someone into any kind of labor. Okay, so non-sexual labor or sexual labor. So force, fraud, or deception are key. And if someone enters sex work independently on their own or with the assistance of a third party, a middleman or whatnot, and there is no force, coercion, deception involved, that is not trafficking. That is a sort of willing, a relationship between two willing people involved in basically a contractual relationship. If there's force or coercion, if the facilitator deceives the individual, and again, this could be labor trafficking into a factory, into offshore fishing, mining, agricultural work, domestic work, if there's any kind of deception in terms of what the work will involve, how many hours a day, and so on and so forth, that would be classified as trafficking. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act was passed in 2000. And prior to that, the United States did not have a trafficking law. It did have the 1910 Mann Act, M-A-N-N, which prohibited someone from taking another person across state lines for the purpose of prostitution. So that's sort of a very early version of an anti-trafficking law. But 2000 is really the year that the federal law was passed, and then all 50 states passed their own trafficking laws. So it's very clear, according to the law, what the distinction is between trafficking and sex work.
But when SESTA-FOSTA was passed, purportedly to, again, protect people from sex trafficking, a lot of people fell under this sort of vague language and were potentially potentially going to fall in this net of crime, when some of it really didn't make sense, like a husband and wife team doing a camming session and one of them being accused of trafficking the other.
Yeah, I guess I would facetiously argue that FOSTA and SESTA were really laws intended to crush sex work, not sex trafficking. And so under the banner of fighting sex trafficking, these laws were really an attempt to squeeze those people who are involved in sexual labor performances out, and to make their efforts to earn a living much more difficult because they can't advertise and perform online as they did in the past. So I would argue that it was a way in which Congress attempted to combat sex work more than sex trafficking, but using the sex trafficking rubric to do so.
Because everyone's against sex trafficking, right? I mean, it's like not, you don't have to make a strong argument. People are like, I'm on the fence about sex. No, everyone's against sex trafficking. So you think there was like some nefarious, deliberate, Ron, you think that they knew exactly what they were doing?
I'm not sure I'd call it nefarious and deliberate, but I think whenever legislators start thinking about regulating sexual behavior, I mean, there's currently in about 15 states resolutions at the state level declaring that pornography is a public health hazard, menace, and threat to the state. And so 15 or 16 states now have those resolutions. They don't have the force of law, they're just simply resolutions. But once again, it's an attempt to combat sex workers rather than actual public health issues.
And Barb, you've written an entire book on sex work in the digital age. And of course, it has changed dramatically. But so on the one hand, people can stay home and do sex work if they're, for example, camming, which of course, decreases their vulnerability tenfold. But on the other hand, sex workers are now on video on the internet saying they're sex workers, which it seems to me exposes them to a whole other level of potential stigma, discrimination, criminalization.
Yeah, I mean, if we're in a real mire right now of countervailing pressures regarding sex work policy. On the one hand, I think we're in the midst of a desire to, I hope it's a long-lived desire stemming from the very obvious shootings of Black men that keep happening by police to reform the criminal justice system, that the criminal justice system has become the new Jim Crow and designed in many ways to keep Blacks and other people of color marginalized. And the prostitution laws are part of that same exact package. And so there's a desire to start to change that. And that's why you also see at the same time a number of states who that are starting to move towards decriminalizing in some fashion. And we can talk some more about that because that's really quite heartening. At the same time, you have a very strong, some powerful and well-funded organizations who believe, like the radical feminists in the 1980s, that prostitution is and pornography are this is a scourge, and the trafficking was just another way to try. The whole rhetoric is another way to try and get those laws under control. And while the original TVPA was passed in 2000 under the Clinton administration, then they took care to try to. There were actually sex worker organizations, sex worker rights organizations involved in making that bill, and they took care to try to keep it to extreme force, fraud, and deception. When George Bush came in, he brought in a number of the more evangelical groups, and they started to chip away at this distinction between trafficking and sex work. And the federal government actually made a statement that sex work contributes to sex trafficking. And that funding has kind of stayed at that level because it's really hard to say I'm for trafficking, you know, like you said. What's happening now, I think, is that many service organizations on the ground who are trying to actually help people, the most vulnerable, are recognizing that, yeah, criminal trafficking happens. It's a very small percentage of what goes on. The bigger percentage is people who are poor and marginalized and caught in situations that they don't want to be in and need help. But service agencies can only get money if they say they're talking about trafficking and they can define it that way. And police departments have gotten tons of money from the TVA to deal with trafficking. I sat and watched a debate in our state legislature just the last couple of weeks when we were trying to pass a law making it simply not decriminalizing victims of sex trafficking, saying that if someone has been somebody has been forced against their will to do prostitution, sell sexual services, they should not be arrested. Well, the police successfully fought this because they've got to arrest them in order to save them. And if they can't arrest them, they can't protect them from their pimp. And if they can't arrest them, well, maybe they're lying. And if they're not trafficked, then they're trafficking themselves, you know, trafficking themselves or trafficking other people. So it's this trap we've gotten into with police at the same time as service workers and other people are starting to recognize this is not what's going, but the money has funneled into there. It's a moral issue for some people. In some level, it's like abortion. You it's hard to find a way to compromise with it. So it's just a mess. It's at the same time at the state level, these trafficking policies, these little mini increasing penalties against traffickers is just sort of exploding. And guess what the data, back to science, says about who is actually arrested and prosecuted? Duh, mostly Black and brown people. It's and poor people. So I think I started off somewhere completely different in this. Things are changing a little bit, and I think people are recognizing it. And sex workers are speaking out. This was I'll stop talking. See, I'm going on too long. The most beautiful thing about this hearing that I was at is that a local sex work organization was part of the process. They were speaking. They were being listened to by many of the legislators, and actually helped write this law. I would not have seen this 5, 6, 7 years ago. So it's beautiful. The movement has grown. Sex workers are speaking out. Sex workers, people with sex working histories are becoming academics, and people with academic histories are becoming sex workers. Things are changing and things are somewhat in flux. So I'm kind of hopeful. I think we're on, we have to get them to be hopeful, but.
Is that true, Ron?
I would just add that there might be some exaggeration, or some people exaggerate the amount of sex trafficking that occurs. And so, for instance, the government data show that about 500 people are arrested every year in the U.S. for sex trafficking. That doesn't necessarily mean they're even prosecuted. Some of those cases are thrown out, but 500 arrests a year, roughly, in the U.S. for sex trafficking.
And worldwide,
about 11,000 people are arrested every year. Now, those figures sound low, lower than what's been claimed. It's been claimed figures all the way up to 27 million a year by the Global Slavery Index, which is based on completely false and misleading and distorted data. And so the number of arrests doesn't mean that the number of people who are involved in trafficking, but it does suggest either that the magnitude of trafficking is much lower than anti-trafficking activists claim, or that basically I think we need to, you know, critically examine those figures. And anytime someone says, well, there's millions of victims every year around the world, what's your source? Where's your data? And often the data are very problematic, pieced together from multiple anecdotal sources, for instance.
And also this speaks to what Barb said about that trafficking victims are arrested. I mean, I've also heard from activists that when a sex worker is arrested, and again, this is like at the local level with the police, sometimes the police give them two options, which is I will send you to jail, or if you say you were trafficked, we've got some funding. We're going to do a diversion program for that. We're going to not put you in jail. We're going to get you some social services, but you have to check that you were trafficked, and then we can put that in our statistics and keep getting the money.
Yeah,
that does indeed happen.
And at least they aren't forced to name a trafficker. I mean, in some places they are, which assumes that there is one person that's making you do this against your will. I also point out that by definition, anybody under 18 who sells sexual services is by definition trafficked. So those numbers go into the statistics as well, and regardless of whether they're forced fraud, under the assumption that anybody under 18 can't choose.
Right. The forced fraud and deception part applies to adults.
And then you automatically can't give consent if you're under 18. Okay. So we brought up hope.
Right.
Let's talk about hope for a second. You were part of this open letter. 250 researchers and scientists signed it to essentially ask this administration to listen to the science and let it inform the policy. Do you think we have a chance with this administration? Do you think we do? Let's take the cynic first. Ron.
Well, I'm the cynic.
That's how we're going to just play roles here.
Well, we also sent our petition signed by 250 scientists to all the governors of all 50 states, because prostitution law is really made at the state level, not the federal level. And so we're very interested in governors also being informed about the science. And it's possible that a particular state like New York, which currently has a decriminalization bill before it, might consider voting in favor of that. I think it's going to take some time, but what's really interesting is compared to 10 years ago, now you have about 5 or 6 states that currently have decriminalization bills before the state legislature. And so there seems to be a critical mass, and even a state like Louisiana is currently considering decriminalization. And Oregon has a measure. Whether they pass or not, I think that it's symbolically important because it puts prostitution law reform on the agenda. And it, even if it fails this year or next year, it's, you know, it took a while for the marijuana legalization bills to pass. The first time one was presented in California, it failed, the recreational one. I think that was 2010. And then I think it was 4 years later, pretty similar ballot measure was produced and it passed. And so sometimes you can build on successes and you can also build on failures. And so even though I tend to be pretty cynical about the chances of any particular state passing one of these bills now, who knows what the future holds?
Okay, that's a really good point, right? Is that when it's proposed, now legislators have to think about it, right? They have to consider it. They maybe have to listen at the hearings. They don't have to, but and so there may be a seed planted there, you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. In which they move from against it to on the fence, right? Maybe that's possible. And then we sort of keep going. So that's a really good point. What do you think, Barb? I'm also concerned about all the judges that Trump put into place. I'm a little bit worried about that. I'm not the only one. Okay, Barb. So first, tell me, what you see right now in the landscape. Do you have hope?
Well, now, see, Ron's going to be the hopeful one, and I'm going to be the depressed.
Good. Oh, good. Downer. We've surprised people. Great. You're playing against type.
While there is hope that more of these are happening, I worry a couple of things. If like marijuana laws, it becomes another opportunity for big business to make rules of the game that benefit banks, property owners, you know, the not the people on the streets, there's a danger in that. There's a danger in it. Decriminalization happens and we go, yay, and miss the fact that things like, you know, national health care and housing fairness and all of that stuff really matter almost as, I shouldn't say that, they matter a lot in addition to decriminalizing.
Well, and they're related. So one would argue that they're also related because we're all toiling here under late capitalism, which sets us up, all of us, to fail, not just sex workers, but actually everyone. And that's especially true of people at the bottom of the hierarchy, as we've seen with COVID. The amount of people who could not stay home, who actually worked in jobs that were low-paying service jobs, had to go to work, and then were more likely to be exposed.
Yep. I mean, it's the gig economy, and the people who make laws are the people at the top, and that's who they benefit. So I worry about that. That's why I keep saying the devil is in the details, people. The devil is in the details. But we're not there yet. And I mean, I hope that decriminalization happens. I I think we're seeing, there's the big decrim bills, but we're also seeing some study bills, which are, you know, whatever you can say about study bills. But as Ron said, at least they're getting on the radar of people. And as long as we don't stop, then that's a good thing. So the
trend, I would add that there has already been some progressive change. So New York State passed a law that it's no longer possible to arrest someone for loitering for the purpose of prostitution.
And this is like walking while trans and black, right?
So if you're just standing on the street and not causing any kind of public disorder or nuisance, you can no longer be arrested in New York. California currently has an identical bill before the state legislature. And so that's chipping away at the edges. It's not full decriminalization and certainly not legalization in terms of regulations, but it is a step in the right direction in terms of removing the criminal justice system from the lives of people who are involved in prostitution. So New York passed that statute, that law, and California might as well. So it is a step in the right direction.
And a critical conversation that's happening right now is about defunding the police and even police, abolishing the police. Where does this fit into that conversation?
Well, it's something like preventing the police from arresting someone for standing on the street is a way not of defunding the police, but of reorienting their practices away from minor crimes toward more serious ones. And so I'm not an advocate of defunding the police. I think it's a crazy idea, but we can talk about reallocating some police resources to other social service organizations or toward more serious violent crimes, let's say, than what could be called nuisance crimes.
I mean, what's happened in the last 20 years more is we've taken all the funding away from social services and given them to police. And even police are uncomfortable with the amount of dealing with mental health crises and social service provision. We have all these specialty courts now that are basically judges doing social service agencies. What social services can do better under a criminal context. It's insane. But maybe we're going in the right direction, generally.
I mean, I think that that's a problem just overall, is the amount we spend on social services does not compare to the amount we spend on so many other things. And so now there are places, there are certain cities which have tanks, right? And SWAT teams and all of this sort of militarization of the police, and that costs money. But then that same city doesn't have fair housing, doesn't have affordable housing. People's basic needs aren't being met. Barb, are you ready to come out for defunding or abolishing the police? This is like Ron made this bold statement. He thinks it's crazy.
Well, I have to, since Ron says it's crazy, I'll have to go the other way. But my answer is going to be the devil is in the details. If defunding means taking away some of their funding and power and channeling it to places that it should go to, yeah. If abolishing means reorienting the purpose and direction of what they do, yeah. But that, good luck. I mean, that's for the next generation.
You don't think it will happen in our lifetime?
No, I think I don't. I, gosh darn it. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I'm not meaning to lead you into an answer.
Something's got to change.
Right.
Though. Something's got to change. The whole dynamic, the whole way in which we punish poor people and are redistributing the wealth upward is just gotta change.
And well, if I could just go back to the decriminalization issue a minute, We were talking about states like New York and California in terms of arrests for street prostitution. But let's also talk about higher end prostitution, escort prostitution, where an escort meets someone in a hotel room, finds out it's the police doing a sting. Those kinds of policies could stop today. And several cities do not do those kinds of stings. They focus primarily on the street and not on indoor prostitution. And so that kind of law doesn't even need to be passed. A police department can decide whether it wants to focus its vice resources on the street level trade or on indoor workers, massage parlors, escorts, and so on.
But if we're then going to focus on the quote street, aren't we then focusing primarily on poor people and marginalized folks, trans women of color, and people of color? Because there are these, I know there are these stratifications, right, of who has the privilege of working inside.
Right. Yeah, it's not either or. We can gradually decriminalize street prostitution like these soliciting statutes on the one hand, and whether formally or informally decriminalize indoor prostitution, so that only in the case where someone working indoors, out call or in call, is causing a public nuisance. Lots of traffic in and out every day, and the neighbors start complaining. Only in those kinds of situations would the police or other authorities become involved. But if they're doing so voluntarily and not causing any kind of public disorder or problem, and no one even knows what's going on behind closed doors, there's no reason for the police to be setting up stings and arresting customers and workers in hotels or anywhere else. And so, like I say, some cities already, they don't broadcast this. They don't.
It's their discretion. You're saying at the police right. level, it's their discretion
yes.
of whether they're to go use resources, go after this, or say, we got other things to do.
Right. The leadership of the vice squad in the police department can make that call. And some cities split their vice budgets 50-50, street and indoor. Others focus exclusively on the street and basically do not get involved in busting indoor providers unless there's some problem, like a report of trafficking or something, coercion, or disturbing neighbors. And other cities put a lot of resources into stings and don't focus much on the streets. So there's a variation, and each vice squad, leadership in each police department, can make that call without the law needing to be changed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, ideally the law would be changed, but short of that, we can have these other progressive policies at the department level, at the city level.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because we tend to think, oh, we want something to change, let's pass a law, or let's don't pass a law. And so much of what happens is, you know, cultural, it's bureaucratic practices. And so you could make a law and the culture and the bureaucracy doesn't follow, and the law will have unintended effects. Or you can change the culture and the bureaucracy and do as much as you would have if with a law. So it's complicated, says the scientist.
Yeah, and there's a term for what I'm describing. It's called de facto decriminalization.
De facto, right.
So decriminalization in fact, but not by law. So that is an alternative, and that can happen at the city level.
But we've got to get in the room with those people. We still have to get in the room with people who have power and
yes.
convince them of this and mm-hmm. sort of de-escalate their anxiety and panic about it. Right.
Which is difficult to do.
Yes, yes, it's difficult to do. Because people are human, right? And we've grown up in a sex-negative society. So we've all like been swimming in this water of what is good and what is bad. And most things having to do with sex are bad, right? Are sinful.
When I did some research with the DC police department's vice squad in the late 90s and rode around with officers as they arrested people on the street. The three vice squad officers told me that they considered their work a waste of time and that they considered prostitution on the street a victimless crime, but that they were mandated by the department in DC to do this kind of arrest. So they would send out a female officer dressed in street clothes and get solicited by men on the street and immediately make a bust. So we went out in a van, and that occurred, you know, five nights a week. And they would immediately bust people. And back then they were impounding the cars of clients who approached a street worker in a car. And then there were hefty fines to get your car back. So it wasn't just a criminal record, an arrest record, but also a huge financial burden for people who were arrested. Some cities still do that. But the vice squad officers themselves described the work that they were doing as enforcing victimless crime laws.
And I will say in the intervening years since then, there's been a lot of effort to convince police that prostitution is not a victimless crime, that they're all trafficked.
Right. So there's a loud faction of people, right, who want this criminalized and want people arrested and want people put in jail, right? So they also have the ear of the police, you're saying.
Yeah, what's interesting, I've never seen a public opinion poll that breaks it down by type of sex worker. So they will ask, do you support decriminalization or legalization or not? And they often don't even define what they mean by legalization or decriminalization. So that's up to the responder to imagine what that might involve. And I've never seen a poll, in the US at least, that breaks it down by escort, massage parlor, brothel, street, and so on.
I don't want it broken down though, Ron, because I think that hits at the most vulnerable, right? So if I'm some businessman in wherever land and say, oh, I don't oppose escorts because FYI, I fucking use them. But I oppose people walking on the street to solicit sex, right? Then I feel like we're back on this like hierarchy.
I definitely take your point and I accept that. I'm just saying for my own interest and maybe for the public interest, it would be fascinating to know how people process the word prostitution. Mm-hmm. What are they thinking of when they're asked That's about somebody, prostitution?
Right.
And my guess is that most people are thinking of street level work and they forget about indoor workers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unless there's a massage parlor bust in their city, for
right.
instance. Right, we don't want to make invidious distinctions between these different types of workers, but they do vary. And I think the public probably has different ideas and maybe different policy preferences with regard to some as opposed to others. And I think that's important to know about, at least, rather than this sort of generic term prostitution, which when people answer those kinds of questions in polls, leaves a lot to be desired. Because I think they might be thinking of street prostitution, and if so, if 45% of the public, if 55% of the public or 75% of the public opposes, quote, prostitution, what they're really thinking about is street prostitution.
Right.
But I take your point. We don't want to increase these divisions among different types of workers either.
Barb, where do you fall on this?
I think this is really tricky. I think if we look historically about how and why progressive policy has happened and changed and why the sex worker rights movement has, I think, gained a lot of mainstream support, it's this politics of respectability. I mean, everybody pictures a prostitute and they picture the black woman on the street with a black pimp and, oh, that's terrible and we've got to help them or arrest them. And, but my, you know, good-looking blonde next-door neighbor does webcamming and sells escorting and they're nice people and oh, then that's okay. I mean, and that's been quote unquote good for the movement, unquote, you know, in terms of, this is why I say this interaction between the culture and the good, bad, and ugly of inequalities that exist. I mean, part of the advancing of the sex worker rights movement has been we have the individual right to make money how we want. We as clients have the individual right to pay for whatever we can afford to, no matter what it is. And that's the double-edged sword of a lot of this. Where do individual rights and structural inequality intersect? I have to give the sex worker rights movement a ton of credit for the attention that they've paid to letting trans and people of color and other marginalized voices take the lead on this. I am heartened by the movements for criminal justice reform, which are speaking from the perspective that we have to protect the ways in which we have just destroyed the most marginalized people. So that's been good. And that in combination with, oh, but there's some really nice, good looking sex workers that are really smart too and go to college and we can't punish them. You know, it's both of those dynamics are at play. And here's what I think, while I'm pessimistic, the movement of culture is towards being more accepting of commercialized sexual services. That's the clear movement of our culture. Our culture is also moving towards increasing inequality at the same time as an increasing attention to diversity and a recognition and acceptance of diversity. So all of those things are happening at the same time. You know, did I say inequality was growing? All those things are happening at the same time. And we just got to be attuned to it and careful about it.
I want to thank you guys so much for this conversation. I just really appreciate it. It's very timely. And I want to remind people about your books. Let's engage in a little bit of consumerism, shall we? So one of the books is Paying for Sex in the Digital Age. That's by Barb Brentz and Tila Sanders and Chris Wakefield. The other is Ron Weitzer's book, Legalizing Prostitution from Illicit Vice to Lawful Business. You can get it wherever you buy books. I especially encourage you to support local and independent bookstores. Both of them are on Twitter. Barb is at Barb Brentz, has an S at the end. And Ron is at Ron Weitzer. Really good handles there, so you don't even have to think about it. And you can find Barb on the faculty website, faculty section of the website at UNLV, which is where she teaches. And you can find Ron Weitzer on the GWU website, which is gwu.edu. Thanks to my editor, A-Rod at FTC Designs. You can follow him on Twitter at FTC_designs. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Tristan Terramino. I have divested from Facebook, so get me on one of the other platforms. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. I hope that this was thought-provoking. We need every single person to be thinking about this, not just legislators, so that when they ask our opinions, we can say we want to decriminalize sex work. Till next time.